We are so
welcome.
Stoked.
Yes,
thank you for coming.
So stoked. I mean, honestly, I said to her and I said to Andre, could you believe that the meeting that we had on 93rd Street could
yeah.
lead to this?
Yeah, I know.
And I was just like,
and here we are.
Holy crap.
How many shows have you done now?
700 and something.
No, 100. Yeah, about 700.
Wow.
And counting.
That's yeah. a lot.
It's yes. ridiculous.
Yeah. yeah.
It's a bit yes. ridiculous.
Do you feel like you've got into a kind of, like a cruising altitude for a process now?
Me, because I was the one who started it.
Right.
It was definitely... going okay, where learning curve since I've grown up where had different influences, you being one of them, and John Stewart
Ross, yeah.
and Colbert.
Me too, yeah.
Like literally, I basically went to her when we reformed it, and I said, okay, this is going to be the Disabled Daily Show,
and
that's
I,
it.
And you I know, struggled yeah. with just going, okay, how to get disability and satire
yes.
together, because it's such
it.
A everyone goes, so you do what now? And I'm like, it's both, not just one.
Shall
yes.
we?
Yeah.
I think we should.
Let's
do this.
Let us.
So where were you brought up?
Like, I was brought up in England, so my family are from Liverpool in England, mm-hmm. and I was born in Birmingham, mm-hmm. and I was raised for most of my childhood in Bedford, which is about an hour north of London.
Wow.
Yeah. Right.
So, smaller yeah. town.
Actually, a kind of a... Bedford's a pretty big town.
Oh.
So, yeah, a kind of a... I think there is a rule in England where you can only be called a city if you have a cathedral in it.
Oh.
And Bedford
oh.
did not have a cathedral.
Oh, so...
So, it's a large town.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they... Well, I've been over to England
yeah.
for studying, playing yeah. and all that. But, like, I was near King's Cross, and, like, yeah, you can only be called King's Cross if you have a train station in it.
And they do have that.
Nothing
King's Cross
else. Oh,
emphatically
wait.
Has a train
and
station.
And also, if you have Platinum 9 3/4 hidden.
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
You know.
I think they have a sign up at
yeah,
King's
they do.
Cross, don't they?
They
yeah.
do. So they have all the muggles walking past going,
yes.
Yes, I'm
yeah.
here. Yes, I'm here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like, what was home life for you like?
Well, my dad was a teacher, mm-hmm. and my mom worked in education as well. And I have a brother and two sisters. Oh. They're all younger than me.
Uh-huh. So you're
I went to
not,
local schools.
So you, oh, wow.
The fundamental thing we have in common is wanting to laugh at the
yes.
world.
Yes.
And
yes.
it's amazing how strong that bond
oh,
is.
Oh, yes. And wanting to laugh at the world through the eyes in which we see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's a very, it's an odd bond between people who love comedy or who want to create comedy, isn't it? Because
oh,
you tend
yeah.
to get along instantly.
Yes.
I don't know if it's, there's... a kind of a feeling of being an outsider as a comedian.
Oh,
that
yes.
That means you end
yeah.
up being, you end up being reacting very
yes.
positively
yes.
or being comfortable around
yeah,
other minds
yes.
that think
yeah,
that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the other thing is that when I instantaneously met you, and you just, like, I explained to everybody, you just popped out of the door.
I did.
I
did.
I'm like.
I almost shit. Walked into you.
And
almost.
Honestly, it was about that close. And I'm like, this, I'm like, that's John Oliver. We're going into John. I'm like, oh shit. Oh shit!
We were two ships about to collide.
Oh yeah.
yeah.
But the other thing is that, like, it's a double-edged sword. So you're an outsider, we're outsiders,
yes.
because of the fact that we have disabilities.
Yeah.
And so I think the funniest thing with, like, comedians and being outsiders, like, we have questions about the Comedy Zone and the Italian M-Bone,
yes.
too,
yeah.
to get to. But
well, actually, you know what? Just to pick up on that theme of
yeah.
being an outsider, like, as an English person in America, you get... it's been useful as well because you have different eyes
right.
on subjects. Just mm-hmm. as
right.
as you guys are
yes.
able to bring a different perspective.
Yes.
Comedy
mm-hmm.
is all about...
Yes.
The best comedy is often about providing... you know, a different perspective.
Yes.
That's why I love Richard Pryor so much
yes,
as a stand-up,
yes,
because
yes.
he was...
Richard Pryor, he's one of my favourite comedians.
Probably the best stand-up
oh,
who
yeah.
ever lived, and it was there was nothing that I could relate to
mm-hmm.
with him. I did not grow up in Peoria. I did not have the childhood that he had. I'd never been to America, but the stories that he was telling were
right.
so fascinating to me, and the way that he saw the world was so
mm-hmm.
fascinating that I became obsessed with him as a... Right,
yeah.
a little white boy in England.
right.
So there was nothing that I really shared in common with him other than the fact that I loved comedy, he made me laugh, and I felt extremely
yeah.
tied to him that way.
I think the funnier thing is that, like, I grew up on, like, the motherlode of British comedies.
So oh, yeah?
I love Rowan. I love,
you do? Yeah,
I
Rowan,
love
Atkinson.
Rowan Atkinson.
Yeah.
He's a huge, and so are you, and so is John. You're all behemoths to me. You're like gods.
I'm not sure I belong in that particular list, but I appreciate being listed in there.
Yeah, you do. I mean, you know, but... You know, I grew up with them, and I grew up with Eddie Izzard as well.
Yes.
So all of them taught, all of you guys have taught, at least me, I don't know about them, you know, how to do stuff in the order, you know.
So Jon Stewart was probably that for me, right? Mm-hmm. So I was obsessed with the way that he was making The Daily Show when I was living in England.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of bad versions of The Daily Show they were trying to make in England. And so I couldn't...
Did that leave a sour taste in your mouth?
It kind of gave me even more respect in a way for what he was able to do. Mm-hmm. And the single-mindedness and the determination to create this very distinct entity that has now... You know, broadened out into there are multiple versions of it. So he kind of, I very much had him on a pedestal in my mind. And then when I worked for him, I was able to absorb like a sponge all the key lessons that he'd learned over the years. So I owe him a great deal.
So in a way, you learned a lot from him.
Very, very much so. I learned almost everything from him. I'm not sure I could have set a show up without working under him so closely, because I saw, you know, the way that show worked. I wanted to be involved in each department of it just so I could understand how that machine worked. And then when he went away to direct movie for a summer, I did his job for a while. So then you really understand how the machine... I used to be a cog in that machine, and then you, for the first time, you drive the machine.
Loved when you took
basically
over.
Basically, we just driving the whole entire truck.
Exactly, you try not to crash it.
Those were some of my favorite episodes. I was on the floor. I was on the floor of the Detroit one, which I told you about.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
And I was on the floor when you did, oh, God, there were so many.
The Detroit one was actually, it's interesting you bring that up, because we did an, it was a slower news day.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we, Tim Carvell and I, who works here, we were particularly proud of that show and a different show that we did about aluminum can pricing.
Yes.
Because when we decided we wanted to make our own show, those two stories, those two episodes of our Daily Show Summer were the things that stuck in our mind of, it would be interesting to do something a little bit like that, that we didn't normally do over there.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who influenced you growing up to follow your dreams, and how did they influence you?
Well, I guess there were comedians that I loved. There was a guy called Armando Iannucci, so he was behind a bunch of very influential radio and TV comedy shows. There's a show called The Day to Day that was initially called On the Hour, which was kind of a true fake news show in the old term, in that it sounded, On the Hour, sounded just like a news broadcast, and they produced it very carefully, but rather than doing it at a, like a 100% parody, it would just like be 120%. It would just sound a little odd. But if you weren't listening closely, it could plausibly sound like the news, and I loved it.
Yeah.
So he was extremely important to me. And then I guess I was lucky enough to have teachers as I went on who were encouraging to me, even though I clearly had different interests than necessarily was ideal in their classrooms.
How was your time at Cambridge?
It was fun. I felt a bit...
We heard on the Marin interview that you didn't like it.
I felt a bit out of place there.
You and Richard O. White.
Exactly. So we both felt a little bit out of place. So that probably helped us. We've got, going back to what we were talking about earlier on, it's a very beautiful place full of people who've had very privileged lives. And if you don't fit necessarily into that particular mould, it can feel like you have no business being there. So we met, thankfully, very early on and started writing comedy shows together and for a comedy group called Footlights there, which is where some of Monty Python had been.
Oh,
and
we did our research.
Okay, so you know.
Who were your classmates in the Footlights?
In the So Richard Iwadi, Matthew Holness, who did a show called Garth Marenghi, about like a fake show about a horror writer.
Yeah.
And there was a guy that's... I spent 1 year with David Mitchell.
Iwadi?
Richard Iwadi, that's right. He wrote Garth Marenghi with Matt Holness. And now he's he directs movies a lot.
Do you still keep in touch with former cast members?
I do. I saw Richard when he was here. He's doing some... he does some travel show, he was explaining to me now. So he was kind of, he was in New York and he was about to go on rollerblades in Central Park. Which is about as far out of his comfort zone as it's possible to be. So I didn't see, he explained it to me and it made so little sense, I slightly doubt that show actually exists. I try and see him whenever he comes to New York.
I mean, my favorite role of his is... the one in the IT crowd.
Yes.
Is my favorite.
He's Moss, right?
Yes, yeah. Moss. And honestly, the entire cast makes that show.
Yeah. I mean,
but specifically him, and the fact that he'll pick up the phone as Moss, like, yes, yes,
yeah,
yes, no.
Yeah.
Push it on north.
Yeah.
No.
It's not a million miles away from who Richard is as a human being.
No.
He would be the first to say his acting skills are... between 0 and 1 on a scale of 1,000.
Yeah, but...
but he's very funny.
Oh, yeah, no, he's very funny.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I love the writer who did that.
Graham Linehan.
Yeah,
Graham. So, yeah, he wrote a show called Father Ted. Do you guys know that?
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah, about Irish priests.
Yeah.
It was very, very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I particularly love that. And he wrote a couple of the... Brass Eye specials, which the Chris Morris was involved in.
Yeah,
the guy.
I love Chris Morris.
He was great.
Going back to first short cameo role in The Bleak House.
Oh yeah! Wow! Wow! You guys have done.
How did you come across that role?
You guys have done some serious research. I was 6 years old, so I did not come across that role so much as they were filming in the area and they needed a child with black hair and brown eyes. So I had both of those things. Yeah, that's right. There was, you needed to be qualified in two ways, and so I was I played a Dickensian orphan. So yeah, I think I was called Felix Pardigle, and I don't remember much about it other than there was a very scary dog who had to bark at us as we went in, they put his teeth up, and so they kind of had introduced us to the dog beforehand, saying, "Look, he's going to be mean later, but he's actually a nice dog." And then there was an actress, Diana Rigg, who I later realised in my life was an extremely well thought of actress. But all I thought of her at the time was she was the nice lady who gave us aniseed balls. So, do you know those aniseed balls? They were a British candy.
Yes,
they were
objectively
disgusting. But they were a nice treat for me at the time.
Yeah. I mean, then. The Comedy Zone, right?
Yes.
We discovered that was Avalon's training ground. So Al Murray came in through that.
He did. That's
you
right.
did.
Yes.
What's his name? Frankie Boyle came through.
Did
that.
He as well?
Yeah.
Wow.
Who else? There are a couple of others, but those were the ones I spotted. But like. What was that like?
It was great. So that was, Edinburgh Festival, which is this, a comedy... it's not just a comedy festival. The arts festival, of which comedy is a huge part. It takes place in August of every year, and we would kind of build our years around it, so to try and do a new show every year. And that was my first chance to do stand-up comedy in a more controlled environment, because it wasn't just on me.
Right.
So
right.
my show... was on it. I think there was a guy called Carl Theobald and a stand-up called Francesca Martinez, who actually has cerebral palsy.
And,
she's very... she's very funny.
Yeah.
And so there was... I can't remember the fourth person now. But there were four of us, and we would each do 20 minutes.
Yeah,
and amazing. It was a great, tough learning experience. Yeah, but yeah. You know, like we were talking about earlier, yes. on, that you there's nothing kind of more exciting than a steep learning yes. curve. So like yeah. when you started this show, yes. it's overwhelming, yes. right? Oh, because you yeah. realize you don't know anything, yes. and you need to learn everything quickly.
Yes. Really, but there's so you go out and you try to get some listeners.
And that's exactly. for thing, yeah.
Right, and you learn from your mistakes. Yes. I think the way that the Comedy Zone was useful to me, and I don't know if you guys have found this, is that. I generally learnt more important lessons from bad shows or mistakes than from good shows.
I constantly
shows.
Go, they're, like, I'm the one constantly looking at our statistics. I'm like, okay, some might not do so. Some aren't so hot, but yet the humor that we've been discussing is all kind of, it shifted to a man.
Right.
And
we all know
man.
At this table yes. what madness is.
Yeah.
Yes. We're trying not to say his name.
Yeah. Yes. There's a Voldemort-esque
yes. quality. Yes. He who must not be White House named. Yeah.
Exactly.
No. But yeah, I mean, so that was a training, a proving ground, right?
Definitely.
So then, did yeah. they then go, yeah, we want you, or...
Or did it take time?
Did it take... More time. Did
who's they then?
Avalon.
That's my management company. Oh, right, they had signed me just before that.
Oh,
I think so.
Wow,
yeah.
Wow.
So they certainly could have dropped me after
yeah,
that
right,
with
yeah.
With some reason because right. I had some bumpy nights.
Right,
that's part.
Right,
that's part.
Right,
of it.
Part
it's
of
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. You kind of when you. Sometimes from a bad experience or a bad show,
yeah.
the hardest and most useful lessons you can learn are, well, why was that bad? What did I do wrong? Or
what didn't work? What happened?
Exactly.
Why did I make the audience laugh?
Exactly.
Or
like, those
or
are the most...
For podcast, it's the, okay, which topics do we need needs to go?
Right.
And what topics...
Or what didn't work and
yeah.
why?
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
like, do you want to... Like, is there a way that you want to try and attack a topic in a
yes.
different way next time?
Yeah.
Or does something feel like...
It's out of place.
It's
or out of sort. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a... That's I mean, we found that even in the making of this show in our first year.
Yeah.
It was often the shows that we were less happy with at the end of the week that we would think, okay... So how do we not do that again?
Yeah. How much research went into that, the four train episodes dealing with Scranton? So I have the photos of it, and I saw the nice monstrosity.
Yeah.
I love the set piece, but I was just like, wait, it wasn't supposed to come to Pennsylvania.
Right, so with those like we call them interstitials,
right.
those little
yes.
pieces that we put in
yeah.
the show
right.
as in a place of
yeah.
where commercial breaks would
right.
be if you were on a,
yeah.
a normal channel.
Right.
There was a production assistant.
How did you find out
well,
about WNEP?
That's a great question. Great question, because it should be impossible, right? And so we didn't stumble on it. We have a guy here, Joey, who's a production assistant who's from Scranton.
Oh, my, okay.
And he, that's right. And so he was aware of this talkback segment
that
WNEP had.
That segment, you could have a ball with that segment.
Well, that's.
You no, I'm
so he, that's
I'm
the thing.
That work for WNEP, and he dreads it. He lives asked to listen to the
yeah.
show, so just be aware. You,
so he said to us,
saying,
he
can have a.
Yeah, he
that.
And an editor, and our editor Ryan here, had put together a compilation of all these calls about the train and the drama involved with this backyard train, and we loved it. And we realized that all that needed to happen was for them to get annoyed in any way by us doing it. And we knew that it's like playing chess, right?
Yes.
You get annoyed,
yes.
then if they can just get annoyed at this, we will build a gigantic train set.
And people did.
And they did, and then we built the train set, and then they turned up here the next day, and we'd already collapsed it with
a
car,
yes.
and we had to explain to them,
right.
it won't fit in your car.
Right.
This thing is enormous.
I have a photo of it. My mom's like, you could use that for... When you interview
it's currently in a railway museum.
I've been
yeah.
there. I know of the railway museum.
Yeah.
Not the most, it definitely has gotten more people to go there.
Yeah,
so,
good.
So
well, that's good.
Doing something.
It's, I'm very glad it's somewhere. It's much better where someone can see it than just in storage.
Yeah. So it was just because when the set designer was interviewed on WNEP, he made it very clear. It wasn't supposed to go to Scranton.
It's like many people who are working class come out of Scranton. The train was not supposed to go to them.
Right.
It was not supposed to be a gift. You're not.
Well, the thing is, we always loved the idea of them having it because we can't use it. So we actually wanted them.
Okay, I didn't know what the story was behind that.
Our idea was, let's build them a gigantic train set. And hopefully they will come and take it.
And they came.
And they did come. And it didn't fit in their backyard. To be honest, we did kind of know that.
You did?
Well, it was...
Oh, because you could view... Did you...
Because we'd seen the... just from looking at their videos...
Yes.
It probably hit us that it...
It would not fit.
No, but there was... It wouldn't fit. But I guess to make it funny, you want to make it... too big. You don't want to make them... Like, making them a train as... That fits is a gift.
Yeah,
making them a train that's too big to fit is a joke.
Yeah.
So we wanted it to be a joke.
Small little Italian town near Scranton. So
we were really happy.
Brings attraction to the
So we were really happy with how they played along, though, because
WNEP loved it.
They were great. They were great. It was a really fun back and forth.
Yes.
And
they played.
They played along. And it was mean-spirited in a very kind way.
My favorite was when, so you got the one episode where you set it up,
yes.
Right? Then in the middle of it, you get the calls and the editing was all together. Then it goes, and that John Oliver, I'm kill him.
Yeah, it was so perfect.
But did they know? They knew.
Oh, and then...
They knew that we had done a segment on them.
Right.
And then they talked about it on their show, and then they
and
didn't...
And then the callers started coming in.
They didn't know that we were going to build a gigantic, beautiful train set
and demand that they
take it from us.
I loved how you used Google Earth.
Oh, that's right.
For the exact... replica of hilarious.
There's a lot of Scranton landmarks on there.
And general area too. I'm like, okay.
I hope they enjoy that for a long time. It's a beautiful train set.
I had to bring up they were both going but it was very funny. It was just especially when knowing that it was hilarious. And every time that it's the point of going, let me watch. I'm save those episodes. I want to please.
Me being a train fanatic, I enjoy checking out the newest and latest exhibits at the Transit Museum or Brooklyn.
Well, I love trains as well. And there's something really... there's something about a train set that takes you back to when you first loved trains as a kid. So it was both a very silly thing, but also I was very excited to see it for the first time. There's something very...
I'll never forget the first time that I saw a train car.
Yeah.
I begged my parents to let me inside the train car, so
we
rode inside the train car and I was elated.
Yeah,
Ever since then, I studied out the entire subway map.
Yeah, trains are fantastic. So I feel there's almost no more exciting object than a train set, especially if it's one that is enormous and shoots fireworks out the top of it.
and
has a waterfall.
And a canary.
That's right.
And everything. Yes. I want everything like Veruca Salt.
That's the universe.
Yes, exactly. That was a strong Willy Wonka reference.
Yes. Like Veruca Salt. I want it now, Daddy. I want it now.
I want an Oompa Loompa.
I want an Oompa Loompa. Wait a second. Don't you mean little person?
That's dated in a difficult way. There.
Right. So we know that your show is all about diversity. That's very clear.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Diversity between the list that's on the wall from every season.
Yeah. So maybe we could describe for your listeners that we're in our I guess writer's room office right now. Yeah, we're in the office, and so we have like there's a massive chalkboard that takes up almost half of one wall, and on it it has a list of all the shows that we've done, the main stories in each show, from our first one, which was about India, to our most recent one. Oh, actually, we haven't even put our fourth season on there yet.
No, you haven't.
So now we've finished it. Yeah, that's right. So to our last one of season three. But eventually we will put the fourth season down as well.
Putting on to that, what do you think of people with disabilities doing satire and comedy? And how would you influence that?
How would I influence it? I mean, it's not for me to influence.
Right.
Other than the fact
like...
I love what you guys are doing.
Yeah.
I think the more voices in comedy, the better.
Right.
That's always been the case. You know, to go back to what we were talking about earlier on about the voices, a diversity of voices, and especially the comedic voice at its best is kind of a natural outsider voice.
Mm-hmm.
You see the world a different way, and that is what is so great about what you guys are doing.
Yes.
You've got a unique perspective, especially on the news, like you were talking about earlier, especially on the news or especially with news related to anyone with disabilities.
Oh, yes.
And I was just listening to an episode of yours where you were talking about that duck.
You listened to us?
Yes. The duck.
Oh, my God.
It was interesting that you lasered in on, there was, I don't know exactly what the story was, but one of the ducker... recipients that was arrested who had a disability, correct?
Yeah, 4 weeks ago.
Right, but it's interesting that your minds go to, particularly to the person with the disability.
We look at it as if someone does not have a disability or is so small-minded
or
enough
narrow-minded.
to look at people with disabilities as freeloaders, as something that is a complete negative.
Yes.
I constantly am the one going on because I handle social media too.
I've been on those, like, the memes. What would you say to the president if he had Thanksgiving with you? And I'm like, oh, Lord.
Is that a daily feeling that you get from people who don't do what you do? Have you felt much resistance to what you're doing?
Prior to doing the podcast, prior to me even having a voice, I felt that growing up, like, I was that kid in special ed until I started pushing my way to say, okay, I'm getting out for these subjects. I don't care who's telling me no, family, friends, otherwise. I will make an impact. I will make sure that those in the public school administration know my name, good, bad, or otherwise. And it kind of helped, and I was that person in school that told the superintendent off and didn't get expelled.
Funny people are often can often be seen as troublemakers in a school environment.
I was a quiet person up until I got pushed so far, and then she reacts badly, and then. And because I was in soccer, played it multiple years, I was that type of person going, you don't want to push your luck, especially with not knowing what my mindset is, not knowing what how I'm going to be processing through the day of bullying, going through the gauntlet of teachers going, you can't do this. No, I can. I'm good with, I know technologies. I'm supposed to have different assistive technologies.
Right.
Don't deny me something that is stayed on a piece of paper.
Like.
So when did you decide that, like, those, when did you realize that you could or that you wanted to make those experiences funny?
Individuals? Just a group?
Or I guess individually, when did you realize that you wanted to, like, you wanted to make jokes about experiences?
I started to really pursue it after, I would say, 11th grade after going, because besides having autism, I have seasonal affective disorder, depression, and anxiety. So for me, I'm very complex, and I've gone through, had TSS workers as a kid,
yeah.
the end, some of them were great. I even got into, like, bullpen with them and got into bullpen with different people who were in the psychiatry. It's out there. It's been out there.
I was influenced from British comedy at the age of 7.
Yeah, and what did you like? So you liked particularly Blackadder, Rowan Atkinson, you said you liked?
I like Blackadder, I like Thin Blue Line, I love Chef.
Chef, yeah, I love Lenny Henry.
I love
nice.
Him. I communicated with Len a couple of times. He was very
nice. Oh, really?
Very nice.
Oh, that's great.
And Don as well.
Oh, wow.
But what impressed me about Chef was that it was a diverse thing.
Yeah.
It was the first thing that was black diversity against everybody else, and he was the only person besides the guy who played Everton.
Yeah.
In that. And then what influenced me about Blackadder was the fact that you could be really, 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 really rude and funny.
Yeah.
And
it was rude.
Really
it
rude
was very rude.
And really bombastic.
Yeah.
And really funny. I mean, and it doesn't have to be cheap laughs.
Right.
It can be major.
Well, that's what I loved about Blackadder. It was very smart and very stupid at the same time. And that's my favorite
there's
kind.
There's been times where like, I just look at having disabilities where, because of me having different stuff, I was going, okay, great, I have food allergies, whatever. But I'm like, no one can make fun of me dying except for me. Or the people that have to give me everything. That's it. That's my rule. But it's like, okay, if someone, if I'm allergic to peanuts, if they were out, and I'm like, okay, no one could joke about me dying because that has had me happen where... I'm like, no, you don't joke about it.
I asked what it's like a kid going, I asked the one to get the injection. Sorry. But you don't count.
But when you're in a hospital room for 3 hours, a lot of
that's true.
And
me, can't breathe.
No,
yeah.
That's serious. No, with the EpiPen, because I normally take it before I even get that so far. I've been in hospital rooms where I made the whole staff laugh. ER staff laugh.
So that's my point.
Yes.
Right? That's my point.
Yes.
That's probably why we get along, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
there's a certain inclination to do that, which is a very fundamental common bond, that you would take a very... a dark moment or a difficult situation for people,
right.
And your only instinct screaming out is to make a joke or make people laugh.
Yeah.
I remember my granddad's funeral, he was a funny man, but it was I felt the funeral was too sad. It was a very dour and everyone was being very sad, which is understandable, but... He was funny. So I was telling a speech. So I started telling jokes about him. And people started laughing. And it was that feeling of starting to... I could see my mom's face watching me do it. And she was kind of saying, that's enough now.
Don't.
This is not a gig. This is not your crowd.
Yeah.
We're mourning your grandpa.
Yeah. And I remember my granddad, right? Granddad, right? So she died when I was 20.
Okay. Gran. We say Gran is like an abbreviation that we often use.
Yeah, Gran.
Yeah. Call my grandmother Gran.
The Gran, right.
Yeah.
My Gran died, and I remember being so sad, and at the same time, in my family, there are two disabled, well, no, now actually four, mm-hmm. but at the time, two.
Yeah.
Myself and her.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to outlast her.
Right.
And I knew that. And so my world for a while became very repressed and all of that. And so my dad said, you could stop crying. I said, I can't stop crying through the blackness, Dad. I really can't. I can't. And he goes, that's not funny. I said, she's been 8 foot down and you're standing there, just not saying a word.
It's
just
awesome.
Totally closed off. The gutter's down. That's it. Nothing. And he was like, I can't help it. I said, cry.
it's odd, though, isn't it? It's odd how all of our reaction to you saying I can't stop crying through the blackness is to laugh. That's not even a joke. You were in pain at that point. We're literally laughing at your pain.
Yes, I know.
That's what I'm saying. Life's too short to be sad all the time.
Yeah.
It's a laugh.
Right. I found that so, yeah.
In that kind of situation when you experience death, you have no other choice but to laugh, to enjoy yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. I think I liked... I had a really fun time doing comedy. This is going to sound very, very strange.
No,
I had a really fun time doing comedy in Afghanistan because my wife was an army medic in the US Army. And so I wanted to do a USO tour. Mm. And so she was in Iraq, but there was a tour to Afghanistan that I got to go on. And she came with me just because I wanted to kind of see the... It was not going to be remotely... similar to her actual experience, but I wanted to kind of see the things that
she was
yeah, exactly, and like eat the food that they were eating over there, so I could feel like I understood a little bit of something that I could never possibly understand.
Right,
and it was a really fun place to do comedy because a war zone is not funny, right?
Right.
But they want to laugh because. That you can't be sad or stressed all day.
Right.
And so they became really euphoric moments of release. And it was not gigs where they were particularly laughing at anything particularly funny that I was doing, more just that it...
You were
they
there?
That's basically it. That I was just there, right? So you become a lightning rod for want people just projecting.
Right.
They want to laugh. Yeah. They want to release. So if you do anything that even sounds funny, even if it isn't, there is laughter coming from them. And so it became a really, really fun experience to do, to have people howling with laughter at a situation which is objectively not funny.
Right. I mean, The Bugle, Andy Zaltzman.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's right. That was my podcast.
Yes, that was your podcast.
I didn't
really listen to from. I listened to it from the day that you got on.
Yeah,
and then when I finished college, laughing like every morning. I was crying.
Yeah.
During what are you crying about? I said I'm laughing so hard I'm crying. I'm like, this is good.
And
you know when you got me crying.
He was like,
good.
You need to turn into this. I'm like, The Bugle. Oh, I'm like, he's like, Jan Lover's on from the day. I'm like, okay. Yeah. Do you want me to do what?
Listen. How did that come? That whole entire partnership.
Well,
I'd
been writing with Andy for years, and I just moved to New York to work for Jon Stewart, and so I wasn't really fully aware of what podcasts were then, but we were struggling to get things commissioned on the radio in England, so podcasts were a great way for us to just do something.
Right.
As you know, you just do it. It's on your terms.
Right.
You have the control to either do it or not do it. There's no barrier of entry that someone can stop you from doing
it. And there's no networks to hold you back.
So it's a big deal, right? Because you can find your audience, just like you found your audience here. So we started making The Bugle, and it was a way to keep in touch with him and write with him once a week.
Didn't you also work with him on Political Animal?
I did. That was before I left. That was one of our radio shows that was cancelled.
Okay, what is Political Animal?
It was a chance to do... We did little odd audio sketches around it, but it was a chance really for other stand-ups, maybe that didn't normally do political material, to do something.
Oh,
cool.
That's
so
awesome.
It was... Yeah, so it was a... political comedy as a term is a very odd way for people to refer to things, because it's just comedy.
Right.
It's all
right.
comedy. It's
right.
just about something. It's like saying animal comedy.
Right.
No, there's no real need to split it up.
I mean, like you're not going to have Nick Park, who created Creature Comforts, whom I love.
Yeah, it's...
And she does too, and he does too, because I showed him all of it.
Yeah.
I showed them. I said, you got to watch this.
Yeah.
And... I mean, my favorite is Leopard, where she's the boom is like,
it's so good.
Right, I've had it, you know, and you know that it's going to, something's going to fall.
Yeah, it was great.
But, in terms of the political, We're not politically correct. You know that. You've listened to us, yes. So you know that.
Yeah.
But also, like, what were the most troubling things on the Bugle? Like,
well,
issues.
The most difficult thing early on was that we were doing it with the Times newspaper, which was owned by Rupert Murdoch. Mm. And it was around the time of the phone hacking scandal.
Yes.
So obviously we wanted to talk about that, and I think we were aware that that's not something that the people who were hosting the podcast were going to be thrilled about.
Right.
Oh, and so bring them up into the podcast. Oh, yeah. Very hairy situation.
Yeah, exactly. But it was fun in its own way, because there's nothing more fun than doing the thing you're not supposed to be doing, right?
Oh, right.
It's like the feeling of being a naughty kid.
A different approach, being a little bit rebellious.
Yeah, exactly.
So wait, when did, in terms of like the Times, right?
So then, that
what happens, like the
they let us go.
They let you go because of that.
I don't know if it was because of that. It was certainly around that time.
Oh wow!
But I can't say it was because
then,
of that.
Because then Richard Bean did Great Britain, which is a play about the phone hacking.
Oh right, I don't know that one.
Oh, it's great. Read it.
Yeah.
See if you can get Richard to get you
right.
something. Right. But they did it between the play.
Yeah.
The digest was between the two newspapers, and.
Huh.
Everything that you probably ripped on was probably in there, and they felt the same way.
Yeah.
They were nervous about pulping the entire thing. And I'm like, oh, crap, then you don't have a play.
Was that in London or in New York? It was in London.
I'll
look that up.
Ah, it's great. But, like, between you, Stephen, Sean...
Yes.
And... Kimmel.
Seth, yeah.
And Seth.
Samantha, yeah.
And Samantha.
Yeah.
And Wyatt.
Yes.
Okay.
And Chelsea Handler.
And Chelsea Handler.
Chelsea Handler. Yes.
Who... Okay. Daily Show.
Yes.
Who are the funniest? Who do you think are the funniest between you guys?
Who's the funniest?
Like, makes you laugh out loud.
Ooh.
If
you were back there.
Yeah.
If I was back there. I guess it depends, right? It's, Sam was always, like, her field pieces just was always funny.
Yes.
In a way that was kind of awe-inspiring, that she would always come back with something.
Right.
Even when the story was quite
she
bad.
She had no chill whatsoever.
She was really, she was amazingly good at it. And then John, I always loved when he was funny about silly things. You knew that he could do, comedy about the news or like in satire, he could do that better than anybody, but arguably better than anyone has ever done it and ever will do it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also really funny. So some of my favorite moments are like when he did his first long piece about how much he hated Chicago pizza.
Oh,
just because it was so dumb, but he was just so funny.
And the bullet point that he killed the audience with was like, pizza.
Yeah.
Pizza.
Yeah.
Right. You don't... Pizza.
Yeah.
Pizza.
Yeah.
You know, there's Chicago, and then there's New York, and then there's pizza.
Yeah.
You know, but I think...
So I loved that.
I went to the Daily Show when you were on it, and you did a piece, and I can't remember...
Oh, yeah?
I know you were with Jess.
Oh, yes? Okay.
And you were at the green screen...
Yeah.
And you were doing something where it was on a beach.
God, I can't
remember
that.
And it was on a beach. And you're like, I can't take this anymore. And you stormed off. And my dad and I were all in the back row just howling.
That's amazing. I can't remember that. I guess I did so many different green screen chats from ridiculous locations.
Yeah. What's your favorite location?
That you can remember off the top of your head.
But the first thing that would come to mind is that we did something about the Royal Jubilee, they made it rain on me.
Oh,
and it rained, it was initial rain, so I was soaking, then it rained beans and toast. And so it was so much fun.